Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is a clinical-focused podcast that I will be doing solo because it's my response to two rather, shall we say, attention-grabbing stories in the field of nutrition, and both happened this last week. And so it's my effort to get out a rapid response to some of you who may be consternated with headlines about the benefits of pasta when you're trying to diet, as well as some blowback against the proposition that saturated fats are okay. We've been talking about studies which suggest that it turns out that saturated fat is not all that bad for you, that it is not the direct cause of cardiovascular disease. And yet this week, in addition to the study that says that pasta is okay to eat on a diet and that it is a healthy diet food, we get stories that tell us once again that we should be substituting polyunsaturated fats from vegetable oils for the arch-villain saturated fats. And so this got to be very, very confusing for consumers because, you know, you have books like Grain Brain, which tell us to stop eating grains by David Perlmutter. We also have the Wheat Belly book. We have people like Nicolette Nyman, who has written Defending Beef, who talks about how animal protein and saturated fat are okay for you. And then we've recently had the dietary guidelines, which have been heavily critiqued because the dietary guidelines continue to suggest a relatively low-fat diet, although they made some concessions in that. They say now, okay, you include more fat, but make sure it's not the saturated kind because that's bad. And, of course, include plenty of high-fiber whole grains. And that has been a source of controversy because, well, we've examined statistics over the last several decades where we've been following that type of advice. That type of advice started to get mainstreamed in the 1970s. And the net result is that Americans on average are about 30 pounds heavier. Now, you could attribute that to a lot of factors, the elimination of poverty and starvation to some extent, the better availability of foods, various types of labor-saving devices, which make it possible for people to do less physical work. But pretty clearly, something's wrong with the way that we eat. And Americans, in fact, are eating less in the way of saturated fat, and yet we're getting heavier, and we're including more in the way of commodity foods, things that are made from corn, things that are made from wheat. But especially sugar. Sugar, of course, is a big culprit, and I think there's general consensus that we should be avoiding sugar. So we had headlines this week such as these. Spaghetti can help you lose weight. Study. Link between pasta and weight loss. Mediterranean diet revealed. We also have this. Italian team finds link between pasta consumption and weight loss. Another headline, pasta actually helps you lose weight. Five diet myths debunked. How's that for clickbait? How to lose weight by eating pasta and dessert, studies reveal. Shock news, pasta doesn't make you thin. Well, that's a headline that sort of goes against that. This one, pasta's not fattening. Pasta's not fattening, here's why. Pasta doesn't make you fat. Huge breakthrough, eating this one food, i.e. pasta, may make you thin. Pasta does not cause obesity but fights it. Pasta linked with reduced abdominal obesity in a fresh Italian study. Scientists shocked to find this one food could destroy fat, and on it goes. So, also when it comes to the argument about saturated fat, there was blowback against the butter is okay mantra. here's what The Guardian had to say in a particularly pointed article. Guardian is one of England's most popular newspapers. You could equate it with the New York Times. It's a liberal or left-wing newspaper that has a huge circulation and a great deal of credibility in England. Eating more saturated fats raises risk of early death, says U.S. study. The Daily Mail of England. Eating a diet high in saturated fats raises the risk of death from heart disease. Medical Daily says the difference between saturated and unsaturated fats may determine your risk of heart disease. CNN, good fats can cut risk of death by 27%, implying that there are bad fats, such as saturated fats. On it goes. So let's drill down and examine the veracity of these claims the lack thereof. And what we really have to do when we see studies like this, I think, you know, as a science and medicine journalist, I feel it's incumbent on me to take a little time and read the studies and analyze the studies rather than take a fresh press release and parrot it. Because it seems to me that the way journalism is set up these days, you have a lot of, quote, science writers, or maybe they have no qualifications in science. They're just writers, and they're under tremendous deadlines, and they have to come up with sensationalistic stories. So it's great when you flip the script, and, you know, 1 week you write butter is okay, and then you write surprise, surprise, butter is not okay. And that way you kind of keep the copy fresh, and you create clickbait so that people are constantly, hitting the open button on your website. And, you know, he who has the most clicks wins. And that's also the way they base ad revenue and so on. So these lurid headlines really lend themselves to the new model for journalism and sort of thoughtful kind of analytics and, maybe balanced reporting that is not so sensationalistic. And people don't have a lot of time for that. It's like, make up your mind, what's the right way to go? So in an effort to clarify that, let's take a look at some of the factors involved in these studies. There's a nice article in the July 7th edition of Health News Review, which is by Catherine Stone, who is a young, thoughtful journalist, who writes the headline, "Eat Spaghetti, Lose Weight? Message from Big Pasta-Funded Study Needed More Scrutiny from Journalists." And she points out that this is really journalism by press release. Hey, it's easy because they give you the press release and almost verbatim, they do your work for you. It's sort of like the way that mama birds pre-digest food for their babies. They chew it up and then they feed the babies. That's the way that sometimes pharmaceutical companies and food interests pre-masticate the conclusions of studies for journalists who might have difficulty wading into the scientific jargon of a research paper. So Kathleen Stone writes, "A news release from Italy's Neuromed Institute this week is driving media outlets from the U.S. to China and all points in between to react excitedly to, quote, the best ever study on pasta. The press release claims that pasta contributes to a lower body mass index, lower waist circumference, and a better waist-to-hip ratio. The press release, however, doesn't include any data. There's no quantification of results, no description of the evidence, such as how the data was collected and measured. And it doesn't even say who funded the study." And that is extremely germane because it turns out that the study sponsor is none other than Barilla Pasta Maker. Barilla Company is you think, well, that pasta business, that's, it's a small subsidiary part of the grocery industry. Barilla is the world's largest pasta maker, and their labels are familiar on U.S. shelves. They were a funder of the study, along with the Italian Ministry of Economic Development. Well, a ministry that seeks to promote economic development of Italian products has got a little bit of skin in the game. And that was not highlighted in the press release. It is, of course, you have to make a revelation at the end of the study. It's what's called a conflict of interest statement. Any study that gets published in any decent medical journal, there's got to be, you know, it's usually in fine print at the bottom of the study, and you have to kind of strain your eyes, and you'll find the information that the study was sponsored in part by Barilla. Now, that doesn't necessarily make the study wrong, because it would be kind of hypocritical for me to say, okay, a study that promotes pasta by Barilla has got to be wrong, when I have often cited studies that are partially underwritten by companies that manufacture nutritional supplements, such as many of the very extensive studies that have been done by Wakanaga, the parent company of Kyolic aged garlic extract, showing the benefits of aged garlic extract. Now, surely they have some skin in the game to demonstrate the virtues of their product. But as long as the studies are done with good methodology, and we can critique and review that methodology, and they're published in reputable medical journals, and they're peer-reviewed, if the study is a good study, it's a good study, regardless of how it's funded. But well, my concern is the way that this study got promoted. It is really, they use the study as a way to expand their market share, because they know that their market share is being diminished by people's people are following low carb diets. The gluten free diets are very popular. By the way, Barilla is diversifying into low-carb pasta, which is great for some people who are just sensitive to wheat. But what they're doing is they're going to be consuming relatively high-calorie starch that in some cases is even higher calorie than the original pasta made with wheat. So what's the problem with the methodology of this study? The study, it's published in a Nature's Nutrition and Diabetes Journal, which is a good one. There's a lot of caveats that really don't make it into the press release, and they're very important. So the study suggests that there is a correlation between a Mediterranean diet and weight maintenance, and it turns out that pasta is part of the Mediterranean diet. Hence, the study's contention that pasta contributes to a lower body mass index really isn't supported by the results of the study. It just, you know, correlation is not causation. It's not like, wow, we took a bunch of people and we told them to start eating pasta, and lo and behold, they lost lots and lots of weight. This is an observational study. So the other problem with the study, and studies of this kind often have these problems, is they looked at people who just completed a single dietary questionnaire of what they'd consumed in a 24-hour period. And the study states the one 24-hour dietary recall could not be considered as representative of the dietary habits of the individual. The telephone-based interviews are under limitation of misreporting and under or overestimation of food consumption. So, and the body weight and height was also self-reported. So this wasn't even, they didn't even go in and weigh these people. People sometimes fudge their diets. People are notoriously poor at recalling exactly what they ate. And sometimes they'll tell you that they ate a better diet than what they really ate. I mean, how many people who you see are overweight, and they, you know, you ask them what they eat, and they say, well, I eat like a bird. And they may be editing some of the departures from optimal diet. So the other thing about this particular Mediterranean diet that's under consideration, where they say pasta was a big part of the diet. On average, in this really hardcore traditional Mediterranean diet, the individuals on the diet consumed what's like a very small handful of pasta, like 3 ounces of pasta a day. And if you look at traditional diets in Italy, not what we consider Italian food in America, because Italian food in America is like lots and lots and lots of spaghetti. I mean, when I eat spaghetti, it's like, bring me seconds, bring me thirds, maybe bring me fourths. I mean, it's addictive. I mean, it's really delicious, and it served as a main course. In Italy, first of all, most Italians don't eat big pasta meals every day, although that's changing. There's more obesity in Italy than ever before, and it's becoming westernized. Typical meals are small. The evening meal isn't even a big meal. And, of course, you sock on more calories when you consume a lot of food at the end of the day. But what we consider Italian food in America is based on a ceremonial meal in Italy. And a ceremonial meal, they got plenty of holidays. They got the saints' days and all kinds of religious holidays and, you know, Christmas and Easter. And, you know, there's a lot of celebrating. But it's not part of the daily diet. And having been in Italy and having eaten at friends' houses who serve traditional Italian food, what you get is you start with some antipasto, which is the before, you know, literally before the pasta. And that could be like some charcuterie, some, you know, some meats, salamis, and, you know, some peppers and vegetables. You go and you have like a little serving, a little delicious serving of whatever special kind of pasta. But that's not there to fill you up. It's designed to be a course. And then you have a course of meat and vegetables. And then you finish with something called dolce, which is a dessert, you know, which is, you know, usually by that time, you don't need a big dessert because you had several courses already. And that's followed by strong coffee and maybe some liqueur. So we in the United States, the average Chinese person would really not recognize the food in a Chinese restaurant in America. They had to adapt it to the, you know, hunger and girth of most Americans. And similarly, traditional Italian food has been sort of bastardized in America so that people consume big honkin' main courses of, you know, pasta, spaghetti, lasagna, you name it. So, you know, one scientist here, quoted in this article, says the following: the fatal flaw in all of this is trying to pull one nutrient or one food out of the mix of the Mediterranean diet and attributing benefit or harm when in fact people don't eat individual nutrients or individual foods. In this case, there were people following a Mediterranean diet more closely or less closely, and the pasta was one of dozens of components of that diet pattern, and they did well, but it was a, you know, does this prove that pasta is, you know, as was simplistically stated, a diet food? He absolutely can't say that. Now this is not the only study that has recently come out that has resurrected the notion that whole grains are beneficial and that they should be included liberally in the diet. There was a study in the British Medical Journal which showed that there was, quote, a reduced risk of coronary heart disease, cardiovascular disease, and total cancer, and mortality from all causes, respiratory diseases, infectious diseases, diabetes, and all non-cardiovascular, non-cancer causes, with a diet rich in whole grains. And there was a meta-analysis in the journal Circulation that demonstrated, quote, an inverse association of whole grain intake with total and cause-specific mortality. And the findings were particularly strong and robust for cardiovascular disease mortality. So, really, you know, we have to critically evaluate these claims. Now, the problem, again, the problem here is that you take a snippet of information, such as the fact that people can, who, you know, consume whole grains, do better. And the implication is that you can eat plenty of whole grain Cheerios or whole grain cereal because there's a little bit of whole grain in the cereal. It's now sort of de rigueur to include a little bit of whole grain in some flour products, or maybe, you know, use, you know, it's all whole grain, but it's still pretty refined. And so why is it that these studies keep showing some benefit in terms of the whole grains? Well, you know, there are headlines that ensue from this, like whole grains can help you live longer, Harvard study finds. Three slices of whole meal bread a day slash risk of dying from heart disease by 25%. And so on and so on. So the problem in many of these studies is that it's really hard to distinguish between the dietary effects of whole grains or the selection of whole grains and what the use of whole grains portends as an overall life statement. So think, if you can, those of you listening to this podcast, of someone you know who doesn't eat any whole grains. It's probably, you know, you travel in circles where people are healthy, and probably most of the people you know subscribe to your, you know, view of diet and lifestyle. But you probably, somewhere in your circle of friends or among your relatives, you know someone who doesn't consume any whole grains at all. They always just have white bread, or they, you know, just eat meat, and they never have any, you know, brown rice, millet, oatmeal, barley, quinoa, none of those things. Well, what you might notice if you think of that person is that people who don't consume any whole grains have completely different lifestyles. That person may be less careful about everything they eat. They may be less careful about exercise. They may be under constant stress. They're just not resourceful enough to allocate time to caring for themselves or to listening to podcasts from Intelligent Medicine. They're not that kind of person. They're just maybe ignorant or unaware of these things. Maybe they drink a little too much. Maybe they have a history of smoking. Any number of things that could undermine their health. Generally, they tend to be heavier because they're complacent about, you know, what they put in their mouths. So in a critique of these articles, a guy named Mike Sheridan, who writes a nice blog, Nutrition and Fitness Coach, it's called CoachMikeBlogs.com, and I recommend that you subscribe if you want. What he says is that he quotes from the what is described as a limitation in the British Medical Journal study. You know, studies often say we found this, but they'll say, you know, a limitation of the study. That's an honest study. It's like, you know, a modest person who says, I'm this and that and the other thing, but I will tell you that I'm not so good at this, that, and the other thing. Well, a good study will say, hey, the study is strong in this respect, but there's some problems with the study, and we'll acknowledge them. It's always in a well-written study. They say that a limitation is that people with a high intake of whole grains might have different lifestyles, diets, or socioeconomic status than those with a low intake. Thus, confounding by other lifestyle factors is a potential source of bias. So the other thing that when is absent from these studies of whole grains is a proper comparison, because it seems like the only choice is to consume refined grains or whole grains. And clearly, if you're going to consume grains, it's probably preferable to consume whole grains. Although some people get moral license from consuming whole grains, and they remain obese and diabetic. they're just not doing that well. But probably it's a little better to consume whole grains. But the comparison that's missing is to people who consume no grains. There are very few people who consume no grains. Unless, I mean, there are two kinds of people who consume no grains. There are people who consume no grains who just eat meat and potatoes and sugary junk. Okay? But, you know, they're probably going to have some cookies and pie, and that's a grain, or fine grain. But there's another type of person who consumes no grains, and that's like me. And I'm a rarity. I'm an odd bird because I'm following a paleo diet. But this is an ever more popular diet. There's many people are embracing it for the health benefits, for weight loss, for diabetes control, for cholesterol control, for, you know, athletic performance, which is one of my major incentives because I lost weight. I feel great. Not that I was heavy, but, you know, losing a few pounds. You spend an awful lot of money trying to get a bicycle that's a few ounces lighter, you know, with carbon components. And then, you know, when your body's, you know, got 6 or 8 pounds of extra weight on it, that, you know, weighs down your performance. So I'm following a no-grain diet. There's no the comparison here to from people who were the study that we'd like to see here is people eating whole grains, virtuous whole grains, versus people eating no whole grains, but eating another otherwise healthy diet, such as I am. And that's a very small group and a very hard study to perform. I really don't think that paleo diet has been systematically studied. There may be, you know, parts of the world where people are eating that way, but they're few and far between. Maybe, you know, looking at some paleo tribes. But then those paleo tribes, they live in clean air, they exercise a ton, and they have very little pollution. So it's, you know, you can say, well, or maybe their stress level is reduced. So you can say, well, they're healthier and some, they don't get heart disease. Well, is it because they don't eat grains at all, or is it a multiplicity of factors that'd be hard to prove? So here's a more reasonable headline from the Miami Herald. You can eat pasta, but load it with veggies and keep serving small. Choose whole grain pastas or lentil, black bean, or quinoa pasta types. Skip the Alfredo sauce, add fresh tomatoes, basil, and olive oil. And they show a picture of pasta where it's almost more vegetables than it is pasta. And the portion is kind of nouvelle cuisine, you know, small amount. It says, in terms of these tips, by the way, this is one of the few articles that note that in the study that showed that pasta is a weight loss food, most important was that the subjects were eating about 1.5 to 3 ounces of pasta. Do you know how little that is? This is a side dish of pasta, not a plate with, you know, pasta falling off the sides, which is the way I used to like to eat pasta. I mean, we were taught, you know, in athletics that you wanted a carbo load before a race. So every time I did a triathlon, we'd have a big pasta party and just gorge ourselves on pasta. It's because we wanted to make glycogen in our muscles. But it turns out that that was kind of an erroneous concept. You know, surely if you're going to do a Tour de France race, your caloric intake has to really go up, and pasta may be a convenient source of that. But these guys ride, you know, 150 to 200 miles a day and go up the sides of inclines of mountains that are at 11 degrees for miles and miles. And okay, they can eat some pasta. They look real thin. So they say load up pasta with vegetables, sauteed zucchini, mushrooms, bell peppers, and eggplant. Make a fabulous pasta primavera. Make the pasta a side dish instead of the main event. Drizzle with a bit of olive oil, lemon, and a sprinkle of Parmesan. Because why? The oil will change the glycemic index of the pasta. Because when you add a fat, it slows the digestion of a carbohydrate. And therefore, it delivers less sugar to the bloodstream in a rapid fashion, which can promote insulin. I mean, if you just drink a soda, boom, it goes right in your stomach. It's absorbed through the stomach into your bloodstream within little half an hour. And wham, you get your pancreas gets signals to massively produce insulin, and your liver has to work overtime and can't accommodate the sugar and then thus stores it as triglycerides in your liver. And that's trouble. But if you, when you have your carbohydrates and you put more butter or olive oil on them, or you can have some avocado in your pasta, or some cheese if you're tolerant to cheese, that's actually going to change the glycemic index, lower the glycemic index. So that's actually a better reportage by the mainstream media, which is guilty, I think, of journalistic malpractice. I mean, you talk about medical malpractice. You can sue a doctor if a doctor makes you sick and gives you wrong advice. Well, I think a lot of people are being rendered sick by journalistic malpractice, which is lazy journalism because they don't drill down and do a proper analysis. Okay, so let's pause because we've gone well over the time that's allocated usually to our first, to our part one. And in part two, we'll tackle the polyunsaturated story, the story about how saturated fats are bad and how you should replace them with polyunsaturated fats. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.